This is Herb Montgomery with Renewed Heart Ministries, and we welcome you to this week's weekly podcast. Our title this week is still The Seven Last Sayings of Jesus. We're in part three of a nine-part series, and this week is entitled Forgive Them, For They Do Not Know What They Are Doing. Our feature text is Luke 32:34, where Luke has Jesus saying, "Then Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing." Last week, we looked at what many consider to be the most problematic statement of Jesus on the cross within the Gospels for readers of the Jesus story today. This week, we're going to be looking at a statement which was probably the most problematic for early Jesus followers around the turn of the first century, from the first century to the second. And simply put, an anti-Jewish sentiment among Christians was present at this time. It was at least growing. And as early as the late first century, in addition to this, not one of the early Christians, or even the later church fathers for that matter, interpreted this passage as being a prayer of forgiveness toward the Romans who were crucifying Jesus. Rather, they interpreted this prayer as being towards the Jews instead. And this produced two problems for the early Christians. First, it was a prayer for the forgiveness of unrepentant Jews on the basis of actions being done in ignorance. And this was countercultural to the anti-Jewish sentiments which were growing. And second, Jesus' prayer, they couldn't explain it. It seemed to have been in vain. It seems to have failed because Jerusalem had been destroyed in 70 AD or CE, Common Era. What we begin to see then, as early as the late second century and early third century too, are copies of Luke where Jesus's prayer for his enemies, specifically Luke 32:34, this first part, where this whole statement by Jesus is missing. And we see some where Jesus' prayer is present, but there becomes a copies that don't mirror each other. So two theories today exist. One is that it was removed by early copyists because of the above problems that I just mentioned. The other is that it was added in later manuscripts and therefore didn't originally belong to Luke. And in some of the more recent translations, you'll find Jesus' prayer here in Luke 23:34 placed in brackets to indicate that. So if you enjoy textual criticism, I want to recommend to you an article this week. It's called A Disconcerting Prayer on the Originality of Luke 23:34a by Nathan Eubank. He's from Duke University, and this was published in the Journal of Biblical Literature, Volume 129 in 2010. But I want to encourage you to take advantage of the whole article, but I want to give you a brief overview of its contents here and then share why, although far from conclusive, I and even non-Christian textual critics too feel that the evidence leans towards this statement actually belonging to Luke and not some later addition. And then lastly, if this is original to the early Jesus story, to the early Jesus narratives of the early Jesus community, we have to ask ourselves what it means for us today, who just like those early Jesus followers, were longing for a radically new social order. What Nathan simply puts forth is that the external evidence for the inclusion or the exclusion of this section of Luke is far from conclusive. He also shares that there is evidence for both the inclusion exclusion in the early versions of Luke, as well as in the later versions of Luke. It's important to also note that even though it's missing in some important late second or early third century papyrus, the early church fathers are showing some external evidence this statement actually did belong to early versions of Luke's gospel. So the external evidence could go one way or the other. There's external evidence for both, an early inclusion and an early exclusion. But there's also some intrinsic probability that suggests that the prayer actually does belong long to the text of Luke. The prayer matches Luke's preferred way of addressing God. Its structure resembles that of the Lucan Lord's Prayer. It resembles Stephen's prayer in Acts 7 for his killers without a single word in common. So it wasn't just copied. It was an idea that was common in Luke, a theme that was common in Luke. And the link between the ignorance of the Jews, which mitigated their culpability, it matches this entire motif that runs throughout both Luke and Acts. So there is some intrinsic evidence for it belonging to Luke. It would fit with Luke and his themes. So as far as the likelihood of copyists actually adding this statement or removing it, the evidence leans in the direction, honestly, of the probability that it was early copyists that removed the statement from some of the early copies of Luke, rather than later copyists adding it to older copies. And what is conclusive, even though that's the debate, what is conclusive, however, is that this statement by Jesus and Luke, it was deeply problematic for early Christians. And then we're going to talk about why here for a moment, but then we're going to look at why it's problematic for us too. The research seems to indicate that early copyists, if they did remove it, they would have removed Jesus's prayer from some of those manuscripts on, once again, those two accounts. That number one, there was some anti-Judaism going on at that time. And number two, Jesus' prayer seems to have gone unanswered. The Jews had been punished unjustly. Jerusalem was destroyed when Jesus prayed for their forgiveness. So the early Christians' discomfort with this prayer, it explains why the external evidence for both readings is early, and as Nathan says, it's early and widespread. In all likelihood, Luke's statement here of Jesus in Luke 23:34, he says, in all likelihood, Nathan goes on to say, it was omitted fairly early and possibly by multiple scribes, while other scribes corrupted the text. Lastly, the research shows that the confidence that some have that this statement was not original to Luke, because no scribe would have omitted something as sublime as Jesus's prayer for the forgiveness of his enemies. Nathan says it reflects a contemporary interpretation of the passage instead of taking into account the actual early Christian interpretations of this passage. And I want to explain that for a moment. The late theory suggests that later copyists inserted this prayer into Luke as toward the Romans. Jesus was praying for the Romans to be forgiven, to increase the guilt of the Jews by exonerating the Romans. And it rightly perceives, this rightly perceives that a lot of this textual ambiguity, it's born out of anti-Judaism that was present during that time, but it ignores a whole class of evidence that suggests that no early Christians understood that prayer as to be on behalf of the Roman soldiers. It was rather a prayer for the forgiveness of the Jews themselves. And if the goal of transcriptional probability, and this is Nathan's statement, if the goal of transcriptional probability is to determine what a scribe is most likely to have written, it would seem prudent to examine what the scribes near contemporaries wrote about the passage in question. In other words, what's being said here is if you try to read how we interpret it today, then it looks like later manuscripts copyists would have added it. But if you look at the interpretation of that passage in the context of that day, it actually looks like there was reason for very early copyists to admit it, to take it out, making it look like it wasn't present in the original copies of Luke, or the original manuscript of Luke. And so anyway, the entire article is well worth your read. It's really fascinating. And the research, as it says, it indicates evidence. Once again, it's far from conclusive regarding one way or the other, but given the contemporary interpretation of the passage during the era that's under question, the probability leans towards its validity as Jesus' prayer actually belonging to Luke's gospel. And I want to be quick to add that the above article is not alone in this. Bart Ehrman, who is a self-professed agnostic atheist and a textual critic, he has nothing to lose or gain in either direction with this. He also leans in the direction of the conclusion that the early copyists would have more likely have been to remove Jesus's prayer from Luke for anti-Jewish motives, rather than, as some have put forth, that later copyists added the passage to excuse the Roman soldiers and increase the guilt of the Jews through anti-Jewish motives. So anti-Jewish motives is used on both sides, whether to delete it early or to add it in the later. But either way, the evidence leans more towards an earlier omission rather than a later addition. And you can look up the E-Site. I've laid out both of these views side by side in two columns, so you can compare them. And I've also given you a link to Nathan Burbank's article. Sorry, Eubank's article that you can go and read. It's not a long article, it's just a couple pages, but it's pretty fascinating, I think. And as I said at the beginning, last week we looked at the most intellectually problematic statement of Jesus on the cross within the Gospels for readers today, where Jesus says, my God, why have you forsaken me? This week, we're looking at a passage which was the most problematic for Jesus' followers at the close of the first century. And I would suggest that on an ethical level, this statement is actually no less problematic to us today, too. There are those today who would also like to say that this was an addition to the Jesus story, that Jesus didn't really say, Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing. There are people who really would rather enemy love and enemy forgiveness not be part of the narrative of Jesus that's leading to a radical new social order. But whether it's in the context of racial privilege between whites and non-whites, whether it's in the context of the extirpation of non-normative sexualities by those who are labeled as straight, or whether it's in the context of wealthy, by global standards, wealthy capitalists in the West discussing what to do about groups just like ISIS, anytime enemy love is brought into the discussion, it becomes problematic for those who would seek to solve society's struggles through an eye for an eye, justifiably retributive means, rather than a transforming of the world through methods of transformation, restoration, and rehabilitation. And I want to be clear. Do I believe that Jesus taught us to forgive our enemies? Absolutely. Forgiving one's enemies, though, it's not a do-nothing approach. Forgiving one's enemies, it doesn't mean that we ignore what our enemies are doing. Forgiving one's enemies doesn't mean that we don't try and stop what they're doing. Forgiveness simply means that we rise above what our enemies are doing to us, and we see them not as evil, and not as beyond redemption themselves, but as captives too, just like us. And as we strive to dismantle the system that's hurting us and others, we see even those who at their hands were suffering, we see them as needing saved from this system too. In other words, we see our enemies as being captives as well of a much larger overarching problem that both we and they need redeemed from. Whether we have enemies, again, within the context of race, gender, economics, or sexuality, Jesus offered nonviolent ways of confronting and discomforting, sometimes even shaming and decentering oppressors, where even those at the helm of such systems of injustice, they're offered a better way. Walter Wink states that Jesus did not advocate nonviolence merely as a technique for outwitting the enemy, but as a just means of opposing the enemy in such a way as to hold open the possibility of the enemy becoming just as well. It means what all of this means. It's when we work out of enemy love, it's a means of liberating the world from oppression by liberating both the oppressed as well as the oppressors from both of their enslavement to a much larger domination system. And the following is from a much more recent champion of social change that's rooted in confrontative enemy love. This is from Dr. Martin Luther King, where he preached his Christmas sermon for peace. I've seen too much hate to want to hate myself. And I've seen hate on the faces of too many sheriffs, too many white citizens, counselors, too many Klansmen of the South to want to hate myself. And every time I see it, I say to myself, hate is too great a burden to bear. Somehow we must be able to stand up before our most bitter opponents and say, we shall match your capacity to inflict suffering by our capacity to endure suffering. We will meet your physical force with soul force. Do to us what you will, and we will still love you. We cannot in all good conscience obey your unjust laws and abide by your unjust system, because non-cooperation with evil is as much a moral obligation as is cooperation with good. And so throw us in jail, and we will still love you. Bomb our homes and threaten our children, and as difficult as it is, we will still love you. Send your hooded perpetrators of violence into our communities at the midnight hour and drag us out on some wayside road and leave us half dead as you beat us, and we will still love you. Send your propaganda agents around the country and make it appear that we are not fit culturally and otherwise for integration, and we will still love you. But be assured that we will wear you down by our capacity to suffer, and one day we will win our freedom, and we will not only win freedom for ourselves, we will so appeal to your heart and conscience that we will win you in the process, and our victory will be a double victory. That is one of my favorite statements by Dr. Martin Luther King, because I believe it illustrates the point this week so well. And where does it all begin? It's rooted in beginning the difficult task of first forgiving those who have hurt us and learning to see them differently. It doesn't mean that what they did was okay. It doesn't mean that you're simply going to ignore what they've done or what they're presently doing. It simply means that we begin to see that they need saved from what they're doing just as much as we do. And this approach, is it problematic? Of course it is. Enemy love is always problematic for both sides. But I contend that enemy love, as it was taught by Jesus and by Gandhi and by Martin Luther King Jr. and many others, it's the only way to lasting change in a healed, restored world where only justice dwells, as it says in 1 Peter. A new world is coming. It's a world of mutual love, mutual care, mutual interdependence, mutual honor, mutual submission, mutual dwelling, where all of our differences are valued and every person is recognized as the image of God. And the first step for many towards this new world is following Jesus in Luke 23, saying, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing. Heart group application this week. Stephen's dying prayer in the book of Acts illustrates the kind of enemy love that we're discussing this week as well. Step one in the wrong direction is to dehumanize our enemies as being beyond redemption. And then step two is to make us afraid of them as if they're monsters. Jesus's prayer, as well as Stephen's, it counteracts these steps and helps us begin moving back in the direction of restoration, transformation, and hope. And evil, yes, it should be confronted, but that confrontation must come in a form that holds out the hope of transformation for the evildoers themselves. This has to be done if we are to not simply become just like them. There are two ways to fight monsters. One transforms them into our likeness. The other transforms us into theirs. And this week, I want you to take some time just contemplating those that have hurt you in your life. And I want you to pick one of them, and I don't want you to ignore what they've done. What I want you to do is just to simply pray for their restoration, their transformation, and their rehabilitation for the next 7 days. Just once a day, pray for them. Don't pray for some divine being to get even with them. This is not a prayer for retribution. Some people say they can forgive because they believe that one day a divine being in the sky is going to strike their enemies for them. And this is not what this is. This is a prayer like the one we find in Luke's gospel from the lips of Jesus, for the healing of those that have hurt us. Not vengeance, but rehabilitation. It's actually interesting, the word there that Jesus prays, forgive. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. They don't know what they're doing. The word there for forgive is aphiemi. And it's also used, it's also the word used in Luke 4, where Jesus sends sickness away from Peter's mother when he heals her. And just fascinating to see that what Jesus was praying for was not just that they'd be let off the hook. It wasn't a permissive forgiveness. It was a restorative justice. He was praying for those who were crucifying him. He was praying for them to be healed, for them to be transformed. And as you do this week, journal your thoughts and your feelings as you go through this exercise. And then number three, share something that you experienced while doing this. Share that with your heart group this upcoming week. Once again, till the only world that remains is a world where love reigns. Many voices, one new world. I love each one of you dearly. I'll see you next week.